I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
We've been talking a lot about the moon over the past few days for obvious reasons, because for the first time in 50 years, humans are traveling there once more. And this time it's about building a path to stay. Artemis 2 isn't just a return to lunar orbit. It's a high stakes test of technology, timing and human endurance needed for the next era of spaceflight. I'm joined by Dallas Campbell, BBC space presenter and author of the new book Space Journal, to explain what has to go right to send astronauts further than we've ever been before. It's great to have you back on the program, Dallas. Can I ask you, first off, right, why send humans on this Artemis 2 mission at all?
Why send humans?
Yeah.
Well, why? What would be the alternative? Well, you could send robotic probes to the moon. We do send robotic probes to the moon. But humans are, first of all, the most amazing scientific instruments in the known universe. One of the NASA scientists, I forget who it was now, was talking about this on the radio the other day, saying that the human brain and the human eye and the human hand are the most phenomenal scientific instruments of all time. So they're good at doing things. Okay, that's the first reason. But also, it's what humans do. Humans like to explore. That's the point of being a human. If there is a mountain to be climbed, or an ocean to be sailed, or an island to be investigated, that we're going to do it. You know, imagine an ocean on Earth, and us standing on the beach looking out, going, "Yeah, but what's the point of going across that?" We're natural born explorers.
No, okay, fair, but I want to take a skeptic's view, right?
Okay,
because if we think about, you know, staying in Artemis 2 and never getting out, because I understand that, you know, landing, I mean, I always think of Michael Collins, right? The third fella who never got to join Neil and Buzz on the moon surface, but just stayed in the in the Apollo spacecraft. I totally get why we would want to put humans on the moon, but humans around the moon makes less sense to me.
Well, because, okay, well, humans around the moon isn't the end goal. You know, in the same way that Apollo in 1969, we put Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the lunar surface. Before that, there were lots of other missions, going all the way back to the Mercury program in the late 1950s and 60s. So we did Mercury first, so we tested some rockets, and we crossed the Kármán line and made it into space, Alan Shepard and John Glenn, etc. And then we did the Gemini missions, which was experimenting with docking into space. So we did all those experiments in low Earth orbit with Gemini. And then Apollo, when Apollo started, we had Apollo, well, the most notable one, probably Apollo 8, which is basically what we're doing. We launched three astronauts, including Bill Anders, who took the famous photograph of the Earth from space, around the moon. So you're asking that question from the Apollo 8 point of view. What's the point of Apollo 8? Well, we did Apollo 8 and Apollo 9 in order to test the architecture, in order for it to be able to make a crewed landing on Apollo 11. And we did that. And it's exactly the same here. So Artemis 2, which is this week's Artemis, round the moon. Artemis 3, just like Apollo 9, will be testing lunar architecture in low Earth orbit. So docking, refueling, making sure everything works. And then Artemis 4, the idea is boots on the moon again.
Did we not take notes in Apollo 8 and Apollo 9? I'm being facetious.
No, it's a good question. It's a really good question, because you're right. We did. We learned a lot. But we're now dealing with an entirely different class of spacecraft, an entirely different generation of human beings. So we do have to start from scratch. If it was just, oh yes, we're using the Saturn V again, then absolutely. But the Saturn V doesn't exist anymore. So we built a new spacecraft. It's a lot more complicated. The spacecraft isn't carrying, for example, a lunar lander. With Apollo, we had all the kit in one rocket and we did all the things and came back. Now we're talking about things like in-orbit refueling, you know, specific lunar landers that aren't attached to the SLS. You know, so it's a very, very different system architecture, which all needs testing. It all needs developing. And also Apollo didn't last for very long. So we did do science. But the amount of technology we have now to do science is orders of magnitude more sophisticated. And that all needs testing and developing. So yes, it is a little bit like starting from scratch, but we do have some notes. Most notably, the important thing about Apollo is this wonderful legacy that, you know, Apollo excited people. Big space projects like this unite people in a time when the world is an absolute mess. Things like this generally have a way of unifying people and bringing people together. So politically, I think it's a good thing.
That's, and like, it's certainly, we need a bit of cohesion at the moment. So let's hope it has that sort of effect. Talk us through the reasons why we're going to the moon in the first, because obviously there's an economic thing, but there is that sort of political element as well, right?
Well, I think, you're absolutely right. I was thinking about this. It's a bit like Greenland again. Why does Trump want Greenland? Well, there's kind of political reasons. There's economic reasons. You can argue about mineral rights and mining, and certainly the moon has that, not least because of the, you know, we know there's water ice on the moon, and water means you can stay there because with water you've got oxygen and you've got hydrogen and etc. And there's the scientific reasons of going back to the moon. The moon offers this extraordinary snapshot of the beginnings of the solar system. If you think about the Earth is continuously being churned up through weathering, through plate tectonics. So all the surface of the Earth is constantly being recycled and remolded, whereas the moon is this kind of perfect snapshot. So it's a great place to do science, to understand the origins of the solar system, and also to do, you know, to do lots of other amazing science. There's the exploration angle. Let's go. It's because it's there in Kennedy's famous speech about why climb a mountain, because it's there. So there's that. It's a stepping stone. It's our first stepping stone into deeper space. So we want to get to Mars, actually using the moon as a test bed to learn how we learn to live off the land is really, really important. So having a permanent moon base is really important. But you're right. I think actually the politics, does America want to be a leader or a follower politically? Does America want to let China be the first to build a base there?
Because they're due to go in 2030, right?
Yeah, well, it is a new space race, just like it was in the 1960s. I see all kinds of parallels of the late 1960s. If you think about what politics was like in the late 1960s, you had Vietnam going on at the same time as Apollo. You had the assassination of Martin Luther King. You had civil rights protests. You had people asking, why are we spending all this money on Apollo when we could be building hospitals? All this kind of stuff was going on. It was messy and dirty. And now we have these muscular politics on Earth, and it's if not repeating itself, but certainly rhyming, as they say. So yes, this who is going to get to that technological high ground, the political high ground first, that the moon represents, and I think there is also a military aspect to this as well. So for all those reasons, the moon has become this prize again, this object.
There's also talk about, you know, economics. Do the numbers in any way add up? I mean, are we ever going to extract any inverted commas value? I mean, the whole conversation to me seems a bit filthy, to be honest, but are we going to get value from the moon?
You're right. When we talk about economics, it's not just kind of mining minerals. I mean, there is, you know, the Earth is made of the same stuff. I mean, the moon is made of the same stuff as the Earth in a different form. But also, even if you did mine minerals on the moon, you still got to get it back. And as we know, getting things back from the moon is rather expensive. But water is the real prize, because water means you can stay there. And actually just having a base there and all the other things that you can do, developing new technologies in a lower gravity, in a completely different system, in a way that, you know, and I think when I say some new technologies, things like sort of data centers that need to be kept cool, you could do on the moon. There's all kinds of things that you could do on the moon. You know, all the kind of new technologies that we're developing on Earth that are incredibly power hungry and require huge amounts of electricity. Why not ship it all out to the moon, for example, and do it there? So there's those kinds of conversations, as well as things like, well, we could get helium-3 from the lunar surface in order to make nuclear fusion a possibility. But just as an environment to do stuff, to do high-tech industries, the moon has certainly become a prize for that.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, there will be great stories along the way of the people who contributed. I mean, I love that about the Space Journal. Yeah. You know, you tell these really interesting stories about the people who contributed to the Apollo missions. One of the ones which I had not been aware of was that there were hundreds of Nazi rocket scientists recruited to build the Apollo moon mission. That weirdly wasn't on the promotional material.
It was funny they left that off.
They did. The
origins of rocketry began really after the Second World War. I mean, there were rockets, but only in the form of kind of fireworks, black powder rockets, and then a group of engineers, well, working roughly at the same time. So you had in America, you had Robert Goddard, who launched the first liquid fuel rocket. That was the real breakthrough: liquid fuel as a way of getting energy into a rocket. And then in Germany, well, in Soviet Union, you had Tsiolkovsky. And then in Germany, you had people like Hermann Oberth and a kind of a real rocket club in Germany in the 1930s. People like Max Vallier experimenting with rocket-powered cars and Wernher von Braun and Hermann Oberth. And this whole culture of rocketry grew up in Germany. And anyway, after the war, lots of those German rocket scientists, some of them went to the Soviet Union, worked on the Russian ICBM program, and some of them came to America and worked on the space program, including Wernher von Braun. So it is a black stain on history. It was conveniently forgotten. It was called Operation Paperclip. And, you know, Wernher von Braun was there right up until the landing on the moon. And he was, you know, he designed the Saturn V rocket. So it is. It's a messy, dirty political story.
So let's talk a little bit, if you're not too cagey about speaking about geopolitics, let's talk about what's happening at the moment. So you have a man who is quite volatile, very focused on how things look, right? And focused on creating some sort of legacy, whatever that legacy is. How do you think his desire for showy results will affect exploration, space exploration? Because I'm sure he loves the idea that Artemis II is going to the moon. He's talked about going to the moon.
Well, he's going to love it when it's successful. When it's successful, however one measures that, he will take all the credit for it.
Even though it was in train many, many, many years before he was in office.
Of course it was. But it happened in his tenure.
Yeah.
I mean, Artemis, you can kind of trace back to what was the Constellation program that George Bush announced. I mean, lots of presidents announced we're going to go back to the moon because it's showy and it's a big sell to the public. The public likes things like that. But I think Trump will do that. I mean, I think Jared Isaacman, the new NASA administrator, has been really good. He's really breathed a new sense of energy into this, because it was a bit sort of touch and go Artemis. I think even a few months ago there were big NASA science cuts. Nobody was quite sure what was going on. I mean, the Artemis program has changed even since last week. I mean, the idea was we were going to have a sort of mini space station going round the moon, a bit like the International Space Station, but in lunar orbit, called Lunar Gateway, and then from there we could do lunar landings. But that's seems to have been scrapped or changed. Everything is now focused on a moon base, like a big proper moon base. So it's constantly changing all the time. But
which it has to be said is very unusual for space programs. And I suppose leaning on the scales, as Trump tends to do in almost every project, I'm just wondering what you think his effect on you know, the programs that are being formed now will be in 4 or 5, because there's nothing really he can do about Artemis except maybe scrap it. That's the only thing he could do, because the science has gone into Artemis, right? What about the 4 years?
Yeah, it has. I don't think they will. They certainly, I think there's a new impetus. I think there is a, you know, and if you want to give credit to Trump,
not
for
particularly.
That, it seems a weird thing to say. But also the things like a nuclear-powered spacecraft going to Mars has been announced. So there does seem to be, certainly in NASA exploration, there does seem to be a new energy. But what we do know about this particular administration is things change all the time, and it is really chaotic. And you know, keeping up with what's going on is quite difficult. And Trump is unpredictable, is a polite way to say things. So who knows what the political situation is going to be next week?
They say that, you know, that history kind of has a pattern, right? And if we look at, you know, collaboration then competition, that's been sort of the swing that goes back and forth in space exploration, right? We had lots of collaboration until we had war. Then we had lots of competition in the Cold War. Then we had collaboration from the 90s onwards.
Yeah.
And now we're back into this competitive space. And I'm wondering, you know, is it just a matter of time before we kind of come to our senses and realize that actually, you know, a shared vision of space exploration and guardianship is a good idea, or can we count on that in the future?
Well, I think behind the scenes there is cooperation. I mean, all the headlines is this sort of muscular politics, America versus China and what have you. But if you look at Artemis, I mean, the control module is built by the European Space Agency. They have a Canadian astronaut on board. So it's not like Apollo, which with everything was American. There is cooperation, and big grand projects like going to Mars is going to require the Europeans and the Canadians and the Japanese and all the other big space agencies and other agents and other countries too. I mean, the rocketry and rocket science and space exploration has completely changed. Satellites have got a lot smaller. So other countries are suddenly coming in. So it is becoming much more collaborative. There's so many unknowns, but we are right. We're in this kind of crazy world of Donald Trump.
There's one more sort of element to this that might make, you know, this a little bit more complicated, and that is the fact that there are large contributions from private companies involved in even Artemis. We've got Musk and Bezos, as both of their space franchises, tech billionaires who are in that space industry, contributing to, you know, America's national effort to dominate in space. And I'm wondering, does that make things a little bit less comfortable for, you know, European collaboration or international collaboration, or is it just, you know, by the by?
Well, you know, SpaceX particularly, well, SpaceX and Blue Origin have both revolutionized how we get things into space, particularly SpaceX. Private companies working with NASA and the space agency is going to be the way forward. But it kind of always has been like that. You know, if we want to keep the International Space Station going, the only way up at the moment is with SpaceX.
So it's all quite tricky. But if you want to just kind of go back through the more romantic days of a space exploration, Space Journal by Dallas Campbell, he's just great at telling these lovely stories, about how the early spacesuits were made, and I love that sort of bit of detail. So if you're interested in just maybe kind of getting into the mood of space exploration at the moment, it's a fantastic book. Dallas Campbell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.